Welcome to the Om Show. In this episode, I'm talking to Jeff Lawson, founder and CEO of Twilio, one of the most successful software and services companies in Silicon Valley. Welcome.
Thank you, Om. It's great to be here with you today.
It's been a while since I've seen you. As last I saw you, I guess, was 2014 or something of that sort.
It's been a while.
What's been happening?
Well, since 2014, I suppose you could say a lot. I remember, I think one of the last times I saw you was when I pitched you the launch of our new product, Twilio SMS.
That was a long time
ago,
too.
That was, yeah, 2010, I think it was. I remember coming to your office and telling you about this new idea that, you know, we let developers send text messages. And I remember you said, yeah, that's nice. I'll write about it. Jeff, you need to lose some weight. And you started giving me health advice. And I remember that meeting so well, and I always appreciated you thinking about me as you know, not just someone pitching you a story, but also as a human being and all that. And I think you've always cared so much about the entrepreneurs that you've had the chance to intersect with. So that's fantastic.
But it's also, you're like a great guy. And I got to know you back in 2008 when you were kicking off Twilio, and we met outside Starbucks. I used to be a smoker then, and I had some health issues, which is why I was like born again, health freak, and not so much right now. I was put on weight again, but I really liked you then, and I still think of you very fondly as somebody who represents the very best of Silicon Valley, a technologist who actually can build a business without being, you know, a person who takes advantage of other people. So.
Well, thank you. I really think that, you know, technology in Silicon Valley, like some of the best things that happen here really come from a very, from the Renaissance person mindset, if you will. And it takes like the whole person and a whole set of experiences to really bring about a lot of the ideas and the innovations and the things that we do here in Silicon Valley. And, you know, I remember like at one point in my career, I was, one of my prior companies, I was building a extreme sporting goods skate shop, like a bricks and mortar retailer of all things. And I remember sitting there at various points being like, why the hell am I doing this? You know, I'm a technologist. I love writing code. There's so many amazing ideas out there. Yet I was getting exposure to like a full stack. I was building all this software all the way down to the Linux kernel and all the way up to like single page web applications back in 2005. And sitting there at various times in this process thinking, well, you know, it's like this experience, we all go through life and we all have this wide variety of experiences and things that we're exposed to. And, you know, at some point you have to believe that the culmination of the unique experiences that you build up in your career and in your life are the things that are the fuel that are going to take you to wherever you go next. And if you have the same life experiences as everybody else, like how are you going to have an innovative idea, or how are you going to come up with some idea that no one else out there is currently having? And so in some ways it is like it's the full human, and it is the full set of experiences that enable us as entrepreneurs or as developers or as creators of things to actually do our best work. And so I think that at Twilio, we're a company, you know, we do communications, we have APIs, we help companies engage with their customers better across all the different customer touch points. But at the end of the day, one of the things that Twilio does, and potentially like the most core thing that we do, and it sounds really cheesy, but I think it is, we help bring out the full human potential in people. And it sounds crazy, and it sounds like, you know, what a nutty thing to say, and I acknowledge that. But at the same time, that is sort of what we're about. That's what APIs are about. That's what being software people is about, because we get to unleash the potential in not just developers, but product teams and actually whole companies to really take their ideas and allow them to see the light of day.
Right. And I think when I think of you guys, it's like beyond that. I just think of it as like a company enabling communication. Mm-hmm. I think communication, or the need to communicate, is as visceral as our need for food, air, shelter, and clothing. If we don't communicate, we're no longer a social animal. And I think any company which enables that has found success in some form or the other. Of course, some become Facebook and some become Twilio in my mind. Like the way I think about you guys is like the enablers of conversations and communication. So I think
it's interesting, and I'll add on to that one thing, which is that I think there are two things that make human beings the unique species that we are, that have allowed us to be the dominant species on our planet. Look, for better or for worse, but that is true. The two things that differentiate humans from every other species is that we do two things better than any other species. We communicate in a more sophisticated way, and we build more sophisticated tools. And those two things, building and communicating, are really what make humans human. And it's, I always find it really exhilarating, the idea that Twilio sits at the intersection of those two most fundamental human things. And that's what gets me and so many of the people at Twilio out of bed in the morning, is that we get to serve our customers. We get to serve developers. We get to serve companies and, you know, and in some ways serve, you know, all of humanity who might have ideas to how to take building and communicating to the next level because of the ideas that they have for how they can facilitate better human interactions.
You know, when you think about that, like maybe you actually have a much better idea of this. We are sitting at a very crucial time in human history where the idea of communication is changing. It's becoming more flat and two-dimensional. We're using words and, you know, digital imaging. And at the same time, the platforms we share and communicate on are becoming a lot more pre-configured and predefined. I wonder what impact it has on us as people, as society. Does it kind of change our evolution in any way?
I mean, I think it's really interesting to look at how people are communicating. So I would say we are in the earliest stages of what I think will be seen in the fullness of time as a great communications renaissance. Because if you think about it, for most of humanity, it was communicating meant just talking to someone who was within, you know, a few feet of you. And then only in the last 150 years could you communicate at a distance, and that was electronic communications. And for the vast majority of the period of time where we've had electronic communications, that basically meant a phone call. And you could pick up the phone, and you had a phone number, and you put it on a business card or a billboard, or you gave it to your friend, and you could call them. And they called you, and people, for the most of that time, they didn't know who was calling or why. You picked up the phone, you said hello, and that was what it meant to communicate at a distance or communicate electronically. But now, in just the last 15 years, you know, obviously we've had emails come into play. Okay, great. And then, okay, push notifications, and then chat on web and mobile. And then you've got video with things like FaceTime. You've got voice over IP. Now you've got Alexa, Google Home. These are all vehicles to communicate. You've got apps like WhatsApp and Facebook Messenger. And so we have, in just a period of 10 years, really completely changed the way people communicate. Even just text messaging, which seems like such a simple thing, has completely changed the way people communicate with each other and build what are now essentially digital relationships. And you think about it, and you can look at it with a skeptical lens. You can say, oh, you know, we don't call each other anymore, or the text messages can be impersonal. But I actually think the frequency with which we now communicate with each other actually keeps us closer and brings us together. And then I think about new things like FaceTime. The fact that we now have FaceTime on our phones means that, you know, my children who live 3,000 miles from their grandparents have a deep and personal relationship with their grandparents in a way that there's no way that would have happened 15 years ago. The fact that my kids see and talk to their grandparents on an almost daily basis, see and talk to them, means they know them really well. When they see them in person, it's just like a continuation of that same conversation. And there's no way. 20 years ago, if we lived 3,000 miles from their grandparents, you know, they would see them twice a year whenever we would be on an airplane. And it would be a loving relationship, but they would not know them.
Yeah.
And that is a modern miracle. And I think that is completely understated, the way digital technologies are transforming our relationships, but it's not up to one company. That's an interesting thing that you mentioned before, right? There's this amazing ad campaign from the early to mid 90s that was run by AT&T. It was called the You Will campaign. You remember that? It's actually amazing. It was directed by David Fincher. It was narrated by Tom Selleck. Like, it was a really big deal. And they showed all these vignettes about how the future was going to be. And they'd say things like, have you ever paid a bridge toll without stopping your car? And they show the car speeding through the, you know, the tollway and, you know, ching, ching, you know, you paid your toll. Have you ever put your kids to bed from 3,000 miles away. And they show a woman, it's kind of funny, but she's in a phone booth doing a video call, putting her kids to bed from, you know, across the country. Or have you ever taken a class while sitting at home? And they show a kid sitting at a screen doing an e-learning and having an interaction with a professor who's somewhere else. And, you know, in the end of it, they say, you will. And the company that's going to bring it to you is AT&T. And they did all of these vignettes. And the amazing thing about this ad campaign is that almost all of these vignettes have come true. Almost all of them are true today.
Right.
The one thing that's not true, the company that brought it to you.
That's right.
And the interesting thing, like, it's not a knock on AT&T. It is just the idea that one company would bring you all of the innovation in the world. There's no way that would happen. The thing that creates innovation is the creative energy of millions of developers and the entrepreneurial system and all the companies that got started or who created entrepreneurial environments that enabled all this to occur. It's insane to think that the future of how we communicate belongs to any company. It's not AT&T. It's not Facebook. It's not even Twilio. But it belongs to the creative people, the doers of the world. And I think that's one of the things that is a core ethos of Twilio.
Well, you look at where we are in this 2019, and like you feel that the communication, and I'm a firm believer in communication and connectedness, right? Those are the two core principles of how I think about the universe. You look at where we are today, and you have, the conversations have become weaponized in many ways. We are not conversing, we are not listening to each other, we are talking at each other, often past each other. The frequency of communication isn't really resulting in fidelity, a higher fidelity of conversation. There's less intimacy in conversations, or so it feels in 2019. What do you say to that? I mean, you look at how things go wrong on Twitter and Facebook these days, for example.
Yeah, I guess the two things I would say. Number one is, like, we're kind of confusing conversation and human connection that has for, you know, 100,000 years been about people that you would, you know, meet face to face and you build a relationship and trust with over time. And we're confusing that with this notion of, like, complete strangers that I have no idea who they are, and my feeling this need to converse with them. And I think that's weird. I'm not sure I understand. Like, it's kind of weird. I never contributed to forums. Like, in the early days of the internet, all these forums, I would read them. I would use them to help solve problems or just research things or whatever. But I never really contributed to them, because I was always like, I'm not sure I understand the need to, like, actually put my voice out there. What's another voice out there on the internet? What purpose is it really serving? Like, it's a trap that we fall into as human beings, as human creatures, to, like, want to make our point, to want to be heard. And that can get manipulated into, great, now I'm going to take some handle on social media, you know, Ohm74982, and decide I need to get into a philosophical argument with this person that I don't even know who they are or where they are, if they're a real person or not, and believe that I'm doing somehow, like, creating some good in the world. And I think, you know, you have to step back and say, like, well, what's the purpose of communication? Well, it's to engage with people with whom we care or depend on. And, like, we're confusing that with complete strangers and sometimes bots and manipulation campaigns of foreign governments. You're like, well, it's kind of predictable. And then you throw into the mix machine learning and the whole idea that the motivation of these companies is not actually to connect us. The motivation of these companies is to keep us glued to our screens. And so there's a reason why companies like Twitter and Facebook are not communications companies, they're media companies. Media companies' jobs is to keep you glued to a screen. Communications companies, the job is to connect you. And so when the job is to keep you glued to your screen, and there's a corpus of data they could use to try to do that, some of which is your friends wishing you happy birthday, and some of it is batshit insane conspiracy theories, and then you put AI to the job of trying to keep you glued to the screen and pick from this giant corpus of things, which one do you think is going to do the better job? Well, it's the batshit crazy conspiracy theories are going to keep you glued to the screen longer than, you know, pictures of your friend's kids. And so that's how you get into the situation we are now. And so I think you take a step back and you're like, look, be weary of a system that is designed to keep you glued to a screen, and be weary of anonymous people on the internet. It's like, you know, and just trusting whatever they say either as either A, true, or B, worthy of your time and your engagement. You know, that's the other insane thing. Like, someone says something crazy to you online, you're like, oh, well, let me roll up my sleeves and try to prove them wrong. You're like, yeah, who are you arguing with? Why is this worth your time? I think we all just sit and focus on the real people that are actually important to our lives. That seems like a much more fulfilling way to live our lives, doesn't it?
You're preaching to the choir here. I mean, I'm not a believer in Facebook at all, and I left the platform because it wasn't being additive. I think that there's a psychological change in society happening because of this high level of connectedness. And I think we haven't figured out the do's and the don'ts just yet. I think the idea of engaging with an absolute stranger is being normalized under the guise of friends. You know, we are friends on Facebook, we are friends on Instagram. Are we really friends on any of these platforms? I don't know. You know, my grandpapa used to say that you can fit all your friends in a car, your real friends in a car. And he was very right. Like, I think in that sense, we haven't really figured out, you know, like what the idea of relationships is. As a believer in communications, as you are, and as I am, and connectedness, looking out, your optimistic view of the world, what is, because I need some optimism right now. So tell me what you think the future looks like over, let's say, next 10, not from Twilio's perspective, but from us as a species, which is connecting so often at various touch points. We as species who have more things at our disposal right now.
Yeah, it's and I don't build myself as a anthropologist, let alone a predictive anthropologist. Yeah. But things that you would say would have been crazy just a few years ago now are commonplace, right? What are the two things people always said? You know, don't talk to strangers and don't get into a stranger's car. And you're like, now we talk to strangers on the internet. We get in their cars because of Uber and Lyft. You know, it's like, well, so everything is upside down. I think that we're reaching this point of recognition that technology has the ability to manipulate the human mind at a chemical level. And what we can do with technology is actually hack the brainstem to do the bidding of the people who write that software. And I think for a long time, we failed to recognize that. And then even after some people recognized that that was possible, it was more like, well, it's an opportunity to go build, you know, sell some products and things like that. And now I think we're recognizing the limitations of our own brains compared to the technologies we're now able to build. And with that recognition, I am hopeful that we will become skeptical to some of these technologies and that answers to it will be legislated and things like that. A lot of this technology is like cigarettes. It is addictive. And it's addictive at a chemical level in our brain. So I think with the understanding that that's what's happening, you know, because before you can change things, you have to really kind of recognize that something, you have to recognize the pattern. And just like in cigarettes for years, nobody knew that the addictive nature of them nor the bad health outcomes. Once you recognize it, created awareness, and then created a combination of legislation as well as public health awareness, you changed how society treated that ill. Well, I think the same thing happens around some of these technologies. And I think we'll see a return to thinking about how technologies are enriching our lives as opposed to just enriching the platforms and the creators that they run on.
Let me add an add-on question to this. It's like, so in order for technology to become a little bit more empathetic and more conscious of the species, it needs to kind of step away from this incessant growth concept we've been living with. The capitalism as we know it is all about the quarterly number, growing all the time. And, you know, a lot of the things which, let's assume, one of the two companies I talked about, whether it's Facebook or Twitter, they need to show growth constantly. Even Google, they need to show growth.
Every company does. That's not unique to media companies.
And in order to do that, there is certain levers that need to push, basically retain all your attention. And, you know, if you get reprogrammed in the middle. So I think at some point, we have to actually talk about, like, hey, we need to really rethink the consumption model more than anything else. Not just the tech companies, but the overall society's, like, incessant consumption. This whole idea that it's frictionless growth forever, whether it's for first the top five companies or it's for the top five hedge funds. I mean, you know, Ray Dalio talks about capitalism has gone wrong, and yet he needs to invest dollars in companies whose stocks are going up or going down. So, I mean, it's like we can't have our cake and eat it too. So we need to kind of be thinking about, you know, consumerism in a very different fashion. And I think that's a challenge I see. We're not, like, we're not really talking about the real problem. So, I mean, the Facebook is not existing in vacuum. It's existing because it's enabling a certain kind of behavior, because it has to justify its existence to somebody else.
Sure. And I think it's easy to look at consumerism's impact and the growth mindset impact on the environment, on climate, on attention spans. Like, there's all the impacts. However, it is also easy to overlook the benefits that the capitalist model has brought to the world, right? Increasing living, quality of life for people around the world. It has eliminated diseases for people around the world. It has increased life expectancies and decreased infant mortality. And, you know, in some places you look at, well, it's generally speaking created wealth for society that has increased all these concepts that we tend to believe because of the, you know, humanist movement of the past 300-400 years, that those are good things for society. And so, you know, I think the way you think about it is, like, with most change and most positive economic impacts, there's a downside, right? There is the gotcha to it. And those are usually the externalities that society pays for. And so the question is, how do you perfectly price into the upside, the externalities, the downsides that they cause to society? And, you know, we have a very imperfect way of doing that. And I think the more perfect we can make externalities, such as climate impact or health impact, priced into the products, then market forces take care of themselves. It's where those things get out of whack that a company can grow and, you know, usurp the resources of our planet or of our own minds, and not have to pay for the consequences of that. And that's what I would seek, right, to say we need to do a better job of that. And if you look at, like, I think Europeans tend to do a better job of that than Americans. But no system is perfect at that.
I'm a firm believer in capitalism. I think what I'm talking about is that I think in the new century, the capitalism of the old, the growth mindset of the old, has met the network effects. And there is some unintended consequences of that. Whether you look at, like, Zara, whether you look at Topshop, whether you look at, you know, Facebook, you know, whether you look at the iPhone or the Android phones. I mean, we basically are growing at a much faster speed on everything, like whether we're consuming our lithium resources, our petroleum resources. You know, we create clothing to basically create more opportunities for Instagram influencers to create more. I mean, just the whole thing is being fed, and the consumerism is being, you know, essentially it's medicized. Everything is medicized right now. And I think that's what I often think about. It's just like, hey, maybe we need to take a step back. Otherwise, we will all end up in a pretty dark place. But again, as humans, we have the answers. And I think it's time to start thinking about those. Talking about things you're thinking about, what I want to know is, how do you think about your life right now, now that you're a publicly traded company? It's been, what, 3 years?
Right, 3 years this week, I believe. You know, I've always thought that, first of all, that communications and the market that Twilio's addressing is essentially limitless in its potential. And therefore, we could keep building this company for decades and decades and decades and build an iconic tech company for the ages. Because how often do you get to see one of the largest and most important industries on the planet, for us communications, undergo a once-in-a-lifetime transformation from its legacy in hardware to its future in software? And so for me, going public is a vehicle to set the stage for the next era of the company. And for that purpose, it served us incredibly well. Like, for example, I believe, especially for a company like ours, like, we're not a consumer company. We're known by developers. We're known by companies who use us. And especially in, say, Silicon Valley, where you've got a lot of software developers and a lot of digital native companies, we're very well known. And then, you know, it's sort of like our awareness sort of, you know, we used to felt like it faded. It was a gradient that faded off as a square of the distance from our headquarters in San Francisco. And so it was like, how do we now take and build the next level where we bring Twilio to more people in the world, whether it's geographically around the world, whether it was to more traditional enterprises? And so creating a bigger stage for ourselves was really the goal. And I remember we went public in June of 2016. And I don't know if you remember, but no companies had gone public since the fall of 2015. And it was because it was that little downturn in tech in the beginning of 16 where, you know, LinkedIn fell and some other things happened. And so no one could go public. And we had already filed confidentially at that point in time. Like, we were ready to go. We thought we were going to go out in, you know, February of that year, but the markets were closed, IPOs and all this stuff. And I remember in, you know, when kind of May rolled around, the markets were looking better, but all the bankers were advising us, look, don't go out, wait for someone else to do it. And if they're successful, you can go out. And I just remember thinking, well, if our goal is to create a bigger stage and get more awareness and the IPO as a marketing event is what we're aiming for, then this is absolutely the best time to go public. And so we pulled the trigger and we successfully executed our IPO, which then opened the floodgates for all sorts of other companies to go. But we got this disproportionate amount of press and media attention and customer attention because of the fact that we were bold. And we decided to do something that no one else was doing. And so that was a great way to start off our journey as a public company. And now it's like we have a bigger stage, but we focus on the things that are the same that we focus on all the time, which is our customers, our product, and our team. And it's like if you take your eye off those things as a public company, the things that got you to where you are, well, then you're doing it wrong. Right. So you focus on product, team and customers to get you to the point where you can go public. Well, that's exactly what you need to focus on going forward. You just have a bigger stage to do it on. And the stakes are a little bit higher. You know, when you succeed, you get a bigger amount of applause. And when you screw up, your dirty laundry is aired in public. And so you just have to be cognizant of that, but ultimately be able to ignore both those things and do what you would have done otherwise. And that's the point.
Have the past 3 years changed you in any way?
I don't think meaningfully. I think that it's still back to the same fundamentals of building a company that it's always been. And if you forget that, I think you're in a lot of trouble. And so for me, it's, you know, always continue to put my head down and like, yeah, I need to spend a little more time with investors now. You know, I've got earnings calls and things like that. But for the most part, great. That's a couple days a quarter, but now it's back to doing the same things we've always done, which is focus on the fundamentals. And that's the only way to build a company, private or public.
So there's a lot of companies which are going public now. You know, Slack went public yesterday. Zoom, which was another public company, and we've had Uber and Lyft and so on. And there's more coming. What do you think is the impact of all these IPOs on the Valley and in the world, in our ecosystem?
So I think what you're seeing now and the fact that there's all these companies going public, it's basically, this is the, I don't know what you call it, the echo boom of the mobile revolution that started in 2008, right? So mobile came along in 2008 with the iPhone and Android, and that enabled so many new ideas to be created, so many new problems that could be solved, and so many new great companies to come into existence. And because of that, you saw a lot of amazing innovation occur that started around that period of time that, you know, it took about 10 years for those companies to get to the maturity point where they could become public companies. And that's why you're seeing this amazing cohort of companies, both in the B2B realm with the cloud, but also in B2C, especially spawned by mobile, coming to fruition right now. And I just think, you know, some people have made the comparisons to the dot-com era and all that. Look at the companies that are going public now. These are great companies with great revenues, great growth rates, happy customers at scale around the world. And this is one of those once-in-a-lifetime opportunities to take this new technology that allows you to build things that operate at scale and to build amazing companies as an entrepreneur because of it. And I, you know, just think back to, like, for most of the human experience, the things that you could create could be enjoyed by a dozen people, a few dozen, a few hundred people. And think if you were a carpenter and you made a table, you know, how many people would ever interact with that table during your lifetime? But now if you're a software developer, you can open your computer, you can type some magical codes into a text editor and publish it to an app store or put it on the web and overnight have billions of people interact with the thing that you just built. That is unprecedented in the history of humanity, right? And so that's amazing. And now I think we're seeing some of the business impacts of that roll through in companies that have been created in this era.
Let's talk about that a little bit. When I met you a long time ago, almost 11 years ago, you had left Amazon where you were part of a lot of exceptional work. And like, are you surprised by the rise of Amazon Cloud? I mean, has it exceeded even your expectations? I know you were there at the ground zero.
I would say the fact that it has had the utility that it's had for, say, developers and companies is not surprising. I think their business execution, the scale at which they've grown it and maintained their growth, that I think is surprising to me and probably even everyone who's built it over the years, because they have really just caught that one by the tail and created a market and created a movement from on-prem to cloud for all of the infrastructure that companies use, compute, storage, that I think probably, and I don't know this for a fact, but I think it probably surprises even them how well they've been able to execute on that opportunity. But the utility of it is not surprising at all. I mean, I remember I started my first day at AWS. True story. I was recruited, and in my interview, you know, Andy Jassy interviewed me, and I said something along the lines of like, by the way, what is AWS? Like I was in an interview. I still didn't even know what AWS was. And their answer was literally, I'm sorry, we can't tell you. You're just going to have to trust us though. It's cool. Which, by the way, is an amazing way to recruit someone, because the allure of that was like, oh, okay, well, you know, I'll bite. And so I moved up to Seattle and started my first day. You know, my office mate was building S3 and, you know, saw all this stuff going on. I was like, this is amazing. Like, it really opened my eyes to a whole new way of building that I had never even thought of before. All the ideas that we had back at that period of time, I think, have really proven out to be true. That if you lower the barriers to developers and make infrastructure easier to use, that will spawn all sorts of innovation, that companies can innovate as quickly as their infrastructure allows them to be agile. And that, along with mobile, has really fueled, I think, this period of intense innovation that we've seen over the past 10 years.
Yeah, I'm always surprised by this. Like, you know, I ran that conference for a very long time. So I was always confounded by the lack of desire on part of some of the other people, other players, to capture this market. And like, Amazon just was on its own out there for a long time. And now you look at where we are today, which is like, we're entering a whole different era of software, right? Like, essentially, the first era was, you know, the way things would be written for client server. Then came the disaggregated software era, which is the APIs, and you benefited quite a bit from that. And now we are on the ML, AI kind of a shift, which is happening.
I think the phases of the software industry are a little different, because like AI and ML is going to change so many facets of our lives and how we build stuff. How you build it, how you deliver it may actually be aligned to the existing models of software. Like the first great era of software to me was the on-prem era. I think 80s, 90s, even early 2000s, you know, that was dominated by Oracle and SAP, and it was all about selling you CPU licenses to some big forklifted in piece of software to run your business. And then, so that was the first great era of software, right? Hundreds of billions of dollars of market cap created, huge, hugely disruptive. And then around the millennium came the second era, which was SaaS. And the whole idea that, no, hold on, wait a minute. You don't have to like have this big expensive sales cycle and this big expensive implementation cycle. The CIO doesn't have to make all the buying decisions, because we can make it easy. You don't have to install anything anymore. You can just spin it up in the cloud. We build the software and we run it for you. So now the head of sales can buy Salesforce and the CFO can buy NetSuite, and you no longer need IT to do all that work for you, because you don't even need that much lifting. And that was revolutionary, right? It opened up whole new markets. You had new buyers of software inside the company. It was easier to start a software company. And again, in 15 years, SaaS has completely taken over from the on-prem model of software. Yet a lot of people have still believed, and still believe today, that is the end. Like, that is the most current thing in software. But in fact, I would say that there is a new era of software that is upon us. And it's evidenced by like, look, what's the fastest growing enterprise software company in history? Do you know what it is? AWS. And they're not selling software at all. They're not selling licenses. They're not selling CPUs or seats. They are selling infrastructure, and they're selling it on a per-use basis. And that is completely restructuring all the major categories of software, compute and storage and databases, and with Twilio communications and with Stripe payments, and sort of every major category of software is getting broken down to its fundamental building blocks and given back to the world to rebuild in the way that they need it to work. If you think about that trend and the financial aspects of it and the scale of the companies that have been built in this new API model, it is really a new way of delivering software value that's different from on-prem and it's different from SaaS. It is the platform business model. And that is incredibly, incredibly powerful.